Hello, this is Stephen King.
Well, sometimes dead is better.
Hi, Georgie.
I'm your number one fan.
Too busy living. Get busy dying.
Here's Johnny.
The voice was in his head, so much a part of him, so frighteningly close that it might have been a part of his own thoughts. It was soft and infinitely sly, mocking him, seeming to say,
"Oh yes,
you'll like it
here.
Try it. You'll like it.
Try it. You'll like it."
Now his ears were open and he could hear them again. The gathering, ghosts or spirits, or maybe the hotel itself. A dreadful funhouse, where all the sideshows ended in death, where all the specially painted boogies were really alive, where hedges walked, where a small silver key could start the obscenity. Soft and sighing, rustling like the endless winter wind that played under the eaves at night, the deadly lulling wind the summer tourist never heard. It was like the somnolent hum of summer wasps in a ground nest. Sleepy, deadly, beginning to wake up. They were 10,000 feet high. So welcome back to the Constant Reader podcast, and this time we're going to be looking at Stephen King's third novel, The Shining, written in 74, published in 77, and one of his most personal works. It deals with the Overlook Hotel, a grand old hotel in the Estes Park in Colorado, the Overlook that literally overlooks the whole country from the highest populated vantage point in the United States. And from there, it exerts its malign influence not only over the people who built it, but also the caretakers, in this case, Jack Torrance and his family, who have been given the job of winter caretakers. Jack brings his wife, Wendy, and his young son, Danny, for 6 crazy months in the country, little knowing that Danny is possessed of a supernatural power, the Shining, a kind of psychic ability that allows him to see the future and read minds and do a bunch of other stuff as well. The Overlook wants Danny for his power and doesn't want Jack, but tricks him into thinking he does. So there's a lot of things to unwind there, a lot of family issues, a lot of classic ghost story tropes. And I'm glad that checking in with me to the Overlook today is Professor Richard Hand, the playwright, the dramatist, the writer, the voiceover artist, the actor. It is an end to your talents, Richard. Please tell me.
I'm not sure. Multi-talentless, probably, Richard.
Now, I know that not to be true at all, for he is the backbone of the Poe Theatre Project, which we'll talk about later, as well as an accomplished director of an upcoming play that I think fans of this podcast will find very interesting. But before that, we're going to be talking The Shining. So tell me, Richard, I've asked you to go and reread The Shining in preparation for this interview, but when did you first come into contact with The Shining? I mean, was it your first Stephen King experience, or have you read his stuff before?
It was really my first experience, and I think I was attracted to it, I mean, as a student, I think because of the Kubrick film. Mm-hmm. Let's get that out of the way with now.
Yeah, unfortunately, anytime you discuss The Shining, it's such an iconic cinema, it's hard to discuss the novel
it's
sometimes.
It's extraordinary. Yeah. It's almost like when doing a lot of work in radio, you can't talk about radio without getting to War of the Worlds at some point. Mm-hmm. And it's similar, isn't it, with King and The Shining, you get onto Kubrick very quickly. But that's what attracted me to the novel. Mm-hmm. I haven't read a vast amount of King, I'll be very honest, even though so aware of his role and his significance, and obviously love things like Creepshow.
Sure.
and his own kind of massive influence on film and involvement in that. And also I love Dance Macabre and
sure.
his writing about horror. I
absolutely.
Think it's absolutely thrilling.
Yeah.
So that's what one thing that's very important to me with him, I think.
Because one of your specialties is radio horror.
That's right.
And Stephen King's written extensively in Dance Macabre and in other places on his early experience with horror being through the radio, being through listening to shows like, was it The Inner Sanctum, that kind of thing.
That's right, and shows like Lights Out. And,
yeah.
And it's fascinating, isn't it? Such a giant of fiction and film, one way or another. paying such homage to radio, mm-hmm. and you know, that's it. And he actually owns a radio station, doesn't he?
He does also, indeed. You know, Banger, yeah, playing the oldies all the time.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Old style radio, but actually, really doing something for the community there, and that mm-hmm. belief in the local DJ and that trope, you know, which is a kind of nostalgia for that. But I mean, you know, he's making a go of it, so it's fantastic.
Oh yeah, I think even though he lives in Florida at the moment, he's very much associated with the state of Maine. And it's interesting that The Shining is, I think, the first of his books not set there. It's deliberately set in Colorado because he didn't want to be associated as like the Maine guy. So tell me, did you enjoy The Shining? Let's put it out there.
Of course, yeah. I mean, I think it's an extraordinary work, actually, and I think it's one I've having sort of read through it again, I think it ages really well.
Yeah.
I think actually the textual gameplay it does, which
definitely.
And I think, you know, I think when it came out, I think there was a certain circumspect attitude to that, a bit too clever kind of thing. But actually, as a kind of playing with modernist structure and style and places, I think it's fantastic, going from narrative description to dialogue to internal memory, and the way it does that, even the way it's laid out on the page, is really fascinating.
Absolutely. It's interesting you say that, this idea of how it's, like I say, very much a modernist book. But as you probably realised, it's got a very kind of gothic DNA to it. Its roots are very much, I mean, it starts with the quotations from Poe, Mask of the Red Death, and it delves deeply into that thing. There's Shirley Jackson in there, I think. There's kind of some Richard Matheson as well. It's all that kind of gothic stuff that really infuses this modern story.
Dinner at 8, unmasking at midnight. You could almost see them in the dining room, the richest men in America and their women. Tuxedos and glimmering starched shirts, evening gowns, the band playing, gleaming high-heeled pumps, the clink of glasses, the jocund pop of champagne corks. The war was over, or almost over. The future lay ahead, clean and shining. America was the colossus of the world, and at last she knew it and accepted it. And later, at midnight, De Wint himself crying, "Unmask! Unmask!" The masks coming off, and the Red Death held sway over all. He frowned. What left field did that come out of? That was Poe, the great American hack. And surely the Overlook, the shining, glowing Overlook on the invitation he held in his hands, was the farthest cry from Edgar Allan Poe imaginable.
Yeah, totally. And I think the Poe thing is very conscious, as you say. I mean, off the Mask of the Red Death and by implication, Fall of the House of Usher and these great Poe architectural domains is absolutely acknowledged.
Yeah.
And I'd also add to the list, partly something I'm working on at the moment, but Henry James as well. I mean, I do think that sense of the child.
Definitely.
And the idea of where does ideas of possession and where do ideas of haunting come from, which may be something very real and physical as much as something supernatural.
Yeah, I think definitely Stephen King and Henry James both use children very well in their books as this kind of focus for these supernatural things, which adds that element of like an unreliable kind of narrator. What are they actually seeing? Is it like through a child's imagination, or are they just scaring themselves? And I love that idea they don't have that filter. They can't just explain away something like the topia animals, because both Jack and Danny get kind of menaced by these strange hedge creatures. But Jack is a few seconds, he's able to convince himself that it's just like a dry drunk, it's just a DT. Whether Danny accepts these things as a part of like his new reality. Mm. It's kind of a safe and unsafe. He knows that's a thing that'll hurt him. He doesn't try and rationalize it. I love that about the book.
And at the same time, I mean, Danny's ability to read minds and knowing somebody's thinking, I'd like to get in his pants, yeah. You know, which he takes.
It's a literal
really confused
thing. Yeah.
By. And it's hilarious, but it's also shows the vulnerability, doesn't it? That there's a whole rite of passage that needs to happen to every child, ultimately.
Yeah, it's an odd thing, isn't it? Being able to have that enormous ability, but yet having so little understanding. And I think that is kind of the breaking point for the for Danny. That's, and as we see in Dr. Sleep later, that's what eventually kind of does for him. He turns out to be repeating the same mistakes as his father. He's an alcoholic. He's a drug addict. He's kind of a callous person because he's tried to sublimate his gift. You see, he doesn't let it shine. And it's implied in the book that Jack also has a bit of the shine to him as well, or a certain supernatural quality. Mm-hmm. So you definitely have that kind of correlation between the two, which I love. Yeah, you know?
And that's kind of reminiscent, isn't it? I think of things like Don't Look Now and other works as well, where that fascinating thing about people with abilities that they don't realise they've got.
Yeah.
There's also David Mamet's play The Shawl, which is about a seance and a medium who thinks he's a con man, but as it goes on, you realise he can't possibly be. And that's really frightening then.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I love that, yeah. So, yeah, it's implied that Jack kind of has a bit of the shine, but kind of associates it with madness and kind of sublimates it and tries to get rid of it completely. And I think that's really interesting, that idea of repression as well, because repression is like a major theme in this book to me. The idea of masking and unmasking and secrets, because the Overlook Hotel has so many kind of dark secrets beneath its very pretty facade. And Jack kind of goes down into that kind of subconscious area of the basement and kind of delves into these secrets, this past, this hidden thing, because he too is kind of a past that he's trying to run from, a past he's trying to escape from. I love that kind of that theme in there. Did you kind of pick up on that?
Absolutely. And I think, again, that's one of the brilliant sort of stylistic features of it, isn't it?
It's very gothic.
Memories come back and they'll suddenly jump scare Jack, won't they?
Yeah.
Memories of his father or memories of abusing his child or whatever. This kind of leaps up to him and it's really haunting in that way. And that repression, that battle with these memories of very real things, seeing his own mother being beaten or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
It suddenly throws itself up to him.
It's interesting how many horror films are about the fact that you just can't bury the past. It's always going to kind of come back and get you in a way.
And I think that's also interesting, isn't it? That kind of digging in. Another text it references at points is Alice in Wonderland, isn't it? And which is a very disturbing novel in its own way,
yeah, sure.
Despite the flight of fancy, how we may see it. And there's that sense, I think, with Jack looking in the kind of the archives about the hotel and what he's discovering and trying to make sense of things and being lured further and further and deeper.
Yeah.
And so, of course, with Danny as well, even more so probably with that room 217 and the
what goes
inexorable
on there?
Drawer of that. Yeah.
And there's that lure of the forbidden as well. It's like the idea of saying, you can't go into this room. But then that's the only room you'll ever want to go in, because you're like, why? And that's kind of referenced by they talk in the beginning about Bluebeard, how he kind of Jack reads Danny Bluebeard, this kind of very gruesome, horrible novel, which ends up with a woman being constantly told, don't look in that room. And when she does, it's a room full of decapitated heads, which is probably not suitable for a 5-year-old. But again, this idea of like curiosity and digging and having to find out the truth, even though it's something absolutely lurid and horrible, and it's probably going to bite you, you know.
Yeah, and it's creeps. Overreaching, isn't it?
It's overlooking.
Overlooking, absolutely, yeah. But I think of that tradition, whether it's Jekyll or Frankenstein or Ash and the Necronomicon, this kind of going too far, and for Danny is 217.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, absolutely. There's a quote I want to read out. The past is a ghost which haunts our present lives constantly. Stephen King said that in Dance Macabre, and I think that's a summation of the Shining. And it's also to do with the idea of isolation, about getting away, because there's this irony that Jack thinks by getting away from civilization and taking this job, he can start again, but of course he can't, because he's a deeply cursed person. He's a deeply broken individual already. But the idea of like cutting himself off is going to be like a new start. And so he can write his play and he can reconnect with his family. And he fails to do all these things because he is I don't know, what is Jack's problem? Because to me, I think it's fear. I think everybody suffers from fear in this novel, which seems like a strange thing to say about a horror novel, because everybody should be afraid of something. But I think in this novel, fear is so intricate and subtle and so different for every character. And I think that's what's at the heart of it. Because Jack is afraid of failure. Mm-hmm. He's afraid of letting his family down. He's afraid of losing another job and having to be put on welfare. He's also afraid of not fitting in as well. He has this great fear about not fitting in. He wants to be part of the Overlook. He wants to be. He wants to show managerial timber, I think it's called. He wants to, because he is kind of like, he's quite an obsequious guy, really. He looks like a rebel, an outsider, but he does want to fit in, you know. He wants to please his masters. He wants to kind of lick the hand a bit. So it's kind of an interesting dissonance that he's got there.
He stepped away from the boiler, breathing hard, trembling. He looked at his hands and saw that blisters were already rising on his palms. Hell with the blisters, he thought, and laughed shakily. He almost died with his hand on the throttle, like Casey the engineer in the wreck of the old 97. Worse still, he would have killed the Overlook. The final crashing failure. He had failed as a teacher, a writer, a husband, and a father. He'd even failed as a drunk. But you couldn't do much better in the old failure category than to blow up the building you were supposed to be taking care of. And this was no ordinary building. By no means. Christ, but he needed a drink.
So, what about Jack was kind of most strange for you? What do you think is... Why was he so mad? What's going on?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I think that sense of cabin fever, which is mentioned earlier, and it starts before they get there, really, I think, because of that repression. I mean, I think a lot is he's haunted by his father and that relationship.
Definitely.
And a deep...
And becoming his father.
Yeah, and that perfectly balanced love-hate that he has there. You know, it's not a one-way flow with that. It's a very complex relationship. But I think you're right. I think that how he is trying to prove himself constantly, and again with the style, how we see what he's actually thinking, which may be the most scornful thing, at the same time being obsequious.
Yeah.
So he's a man in dilemma, I think, like that, and that makes him such a fascinating figure. And
Dilemma, that's good. Because he can flip in a couple of sentences. He can flip from being like, I'm really worried about Danny, to saying, why has he done this? I hate this kid. You know, he loves his wife, but he always fantasizes about murdering her. And it's just, he can't settle. He's completely, it's a maelstrom. He's a maelstrom of a man, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And he kind of sucks other people into this madness as well.
He was trying to qualify things and justify things, saying, I'm going to punish Danny, but not as bad as some people would punish him. Yeah. Therefore, I'm a good dad.
Yeah, he's always saying, I'm a nice guy, aren't I? Yeah. But then he remembers the time he beat up a student and smashed his face in. And he goes, but yeah, I didn't. I'm a nice guy. And the students accused him of setting forward this timer in a debate thing. And at the beginning, when he's monologuing to himself, he says, I didn't mess with the timer. I didn't touch that. You know, this kid's crazy. And then at the end, he's kind of like, well, what if I did? You know, oh, maybe I said it a minute ahead. And then he's like, I said it a minute ahead. So he's lying to himself as well. He's constantly lying to himself.
And I think that's in the end, what he does with his identity. Defaces himself.
Yeah, he smashes himself repeatedly in the face at the end.
That's the... You know, that gets rid of that mask, doesn't it? You know, where he's trying to justify and qualify and you know, explain. And I mean, but at the same time, there's points I think we feel very sorry for him. I was thinking, like,
he's not an unlikable character.
And in fact, that love that Danny has for him, is attractive, isn't it? And you don't necessarily think, hang on, it's completely repellent, and you know, it's not that simple. But it's that things turn around to bite him, like with the wasp's nest, isn't it? Destroys the wasps in it. It'd be a nice sort of present for Danny, a weird present, admittedly. but it backfires, and he can't understand that. His own worst enemy sometimes.
It's interesting you should say that about the wasp's nest, because I've read The Shining probably about 3 or 4 times now, and this was the first time I really kind of picked up on this idea of the wasp's nest as a symbol for something else. Mm-hmm. And I like the idea that you have 3 characters throughout the book who both deal with a wasp's nest and what it says about their kind of the character itself. So you have Jack, who sees this wasp's nest and puts a bug bomb in, kind of thinks he's killed all the wasps, takes it down and gives it to his son. And he kind of goes about it quite scientifically. He's making an effort. He's done what he thinks to be the right thing by using the bug bomb. And he gives it to his son as a gift, saying, look, I've made this not dangerous for you. You know, this is no longer, there's no wasps, this isn't harmful for you. And of course it goes horribly wrong, like everything else he does, and the wasps are still in there, because he hasn't really got rid of them, because he's a cursed person, because he's a broken person.
He let himself down to the edge of the roof, dropped one leg over and felt around until his foot found the top rung of the ladder just below the overhang. He would go down to the equipment shed where he'd stored the bug bomb on a high shelf out of Danny's reach. He would get it, come back up, and then they would be the ones surprised. You could be stung, but you could also sting back. He believed that sincerely. 2 hours from now, the nest would be just so much chewed paper, and Danny could have it in his room if he wanted to. Jack had had one in his room when he was just a kid. It had always smelled faintly of wood smoke and gasoline. You could have it right by the head of his bed. It wouldn't hurt him. I'm getting better. The sound of his own voice, confident in the silent afternoon, reassured him even though he hadn't meant to speak aloud. He was getting better. It was possible to graduate from passive to active, to take the thing that had once driven you nearly to madness as a neutral prize of no more than occasional academic interest.
But also his father also does it with a wasp nest. He smokes them out and then he burns them to death, which is this kind of very violent, very kind of methodical way of dealing with these things. But he knows not to pass it on to his son, because he knows that that's, you know, the wrong way of doing things. But then you've also got Halloran, who at the end of the book talks about when he was a kid and he found a wasp nest with his brother. And what they did was they threw a firework into it and just blew it up and then ran away. And I think that's kind of a really interesting metaphor for, you know, the innate violence of people and how you deal with that kind of inner structure. This idea of the wasp nest is kind of hollow shell that you fill with, you know, fire or violence or anger. And Halloran, because he's like the good father figure, he just blows it up and runs away. He just doesn't have anything to do with it, doesn't try and keep it, doesn't try and make a lesson out of it, just runs away. I really love that metaphor.
Wendy had pressed her face against Halloran's back to cut out the wind, and Danny had likewise pressed his face against his mother's back. And so it was only Halloran who saw the final thing, and he never spoke of it. From the window of the presidential suite, he thought he saw a huge, dark shape issue, blotting out the snowfield behind it. For a moment it assumed the shape of a huge, obscene manta, and then the wind seemed to catch it, to tear it, and shred it like old dark paper. It fragmented, was caught in a whirling eddy of smoke, and a moment later it was gone as if it had never been. But in those few seconds, as it whirled blackly, dancing like negative motes of light, he remembered something from his childhood, 50 years ago or more. He and his brother had come upon a huge nest of ground wasps just north of their farm. It had been tucked into a hollow beneath the earth in an old lightning-blasted tree. His brother had had a big old firework in the band of his hat, saved all the way from the 4th of July. He lighted it and tossed it at the nest. It exploded with a loud bang and an angry rising hum. Almost a low shriek had risen from the blasted nest. It had run away as if demons had been at their heels. In a way, Halloran supposed, demons had been. And looking back over his shoulder, as he was now, he had on that day seen the large dark cloud of hornets rising in the hot air, swirling together, breaking apart, looking for whatever enemy had done this to their homes so that they, the single group intelligence, could sting it to death. Then the thing in the sky was gone, and it might only have been smoke or a great flapping swatch of wallpaper after all, and there was only the overlook, a flaming pyre in the roaring throat of the night.
That's right, and it sort of turns up other places, doesn't it? Because it is, I think I'm right in thinking, doesn't Danny think of the thing in 217 as having this unthinking malice, wanting this unthinking hurt,
yeah,
like the wasp that's
exactly
on his hand, you know,
and that also emerges from like an ice kind of frozen bath, and all this scum kind of emerges out of that thing and comes up. It's a horrible image, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Although, going back to wasps, that also reminded me a lot of Peter Straub's ghost story as well, in which the central character at the end becomes this kind of hornet So it's an interesting, like, two kind of writers writing at the same time would have this kind of concept. I love that idea, that correlation.
Mm-hmm.
So can I ask, when you were reading The Shining, did you see Jack Nicholson?
No, I don't think I did, actually.
It's hard to get away from.
It is hard to get away from. And I suppose this is... It's a cultural phenomenon, fascination, isn't it? This particular adaptation, which is a magnificent film.
Oh, of course.
And this
tell
novel,
that to Stephen King, though.
Because, but you kind of appoints... There's certain things you think, yeah, this is captured so well in the film.
Mm.
Like Danny saying, I heard music like from a long time ago.
Mm.
And how that is done magnificently in the film and so on. So those kinds of things. But no, I think Jack Torrance in the novel is, you know, I think for some of the reasons we've talked about. I mean, I think Jack Nicholson's a magnificent actor and everything. But I think that idea that... he starts at a certain level.
It plays out like a hostage situation throughout the whole film, doesn't
it? Yeah.
You're always, why are they with this guy? He's obviously unhinged, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And although the television adaptation, scripted by King himself, wasn't it? It had its moments, but the characterisation of Jack there, I could see, you know, that was more of a correlation with the novel, wasn't it?
I think when... part of King's problem with Kubrick's film was that, again, he thought it was miscast, and he wanted, I think, the names that keep on coming up when I look into it is John Voight or Michael Moriarty to play Jack Torrance. And both of them I can kind of see, because they can both play that kind of decent, essential decent people, but also quite like vulnerable people who are brittle in some way, with that fragility, you know. So either of them, I think, would have been more interesting.
James Caan and Misery.
James Caan, you saw him in Misery.
Well, just thinking how he is in The Godfather.
Yeah, like because...
Spontaneous violence to him.
Yeah, he could just break out with that. But he could also be nice as well. He's kind of charming.
So something I love about the novel, I think, is that journey of Jack. And as I said, you know, there's horrors to him, and you're in his head. You know, you really are when you get these sudden flashbacks, involuntary flashbacks. But you know, so I mean, that's something that's magnificent about it.
Yeah,
and that
this inhuman
tragedy comedy to
makes
it
human
point.
Monsters, doesn't it? Mm. Exactly, and he is already kind of slightly broken, and the Overlook just makes it so much worse.
Mm. We're getting these flashbacks. Pre-story subtext, but also literary allusion, where Poe will suddenly come out and grab you, or, you know, other texts as well.
But it's interesting about the literary allusion thing is that Jack is very much wants to be a serious writer. He calls Poe the great American hack at one point during the narrative, which I think is lovely. And you can imagine maybe it's King looking at perhaps his college kind of compatriots where he was teaching. People trying to write the great American novel and kind of not working because that's probably impossible to do. And him being kind of derided for being something of a great American hack himself, which I like the idea of.
But I think what's interesting, again, I mean, again, with that modernist aspect, even thinking of something like James Joyce's Ulysses, where we have multiple perspectives. I mean, you know, extraordinary ambition and everything. But sometimes quoting different types of text, and even The Shining does that, doesn't it, with the newspaper cuttings and
everything, absolutely.
And actually going into different font and different kind of levels of reportage.
Which was something you'd done before in Carrie, because that's, again, made up of like bits and pieces and scrapbooks and patchwork from everywhere.
And that's such a modernist technique, isn't it?
Sure,
and I know, yes, I mean, it's a
Dracula
generation.
Did it, though,
it's a postmodern text, perhaps. But, you know, it's still really kind of fascinating, and that kind of sense of where the reader is in that and where that takes the reader through.
Oh, definitely.
So you're getting the capture of the phonetic capture of a stuttering child or whatever it might be. But then through to the sort of mundane text from newspapers and it's a real wonderful collage of texts.
And like I say, the mundanity of it, I think, is very effective, because he does sketch very easily and clearly the idea of a kind of a working class family very well. He gets the details right. He gets like the fact that they're kind of overwhelmed to be in this grand hotel, how it feels kind of alien to them, not only because it's haunted, but also it's because somewhere they could never afford to stay unless they were working there. Mm-hmm. And I think society and class is kind of a bit of a theme in this book, personally. And I think that's kind of exemplified by or by Watson, the caretaker. Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting that his grandfather, I think, built the place. And he works there as a handyman. And I think Jack is also obsessed with the idea that he taught in this Stovington prep school, but then he might have to go and like pick fruit in California. And the idea of losing your place, I think, is kind of very big on this in this book. What did you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. And also the hotel itself, I think, that sort of grandeur to it and everything, that the faded glory, partly a seasonal thing,
yeah,
but also, you know, that the baggage it's collected makes it more complicated.
Yeah, it's seasonal, kind of an annual way as well, because it closes 6 months a year, but also seasonal in terms of it's seen a lot of American history. And it's kind of closed down during like the bust years, the stock market crash. And it's also had the boom years afterwards, and it's been kind of taken up by various types of people. Like you've got Horace DeWent, who's this kind of very shady Howard Hughes type character, mm-hmm. who's kind of made his money in a very shady way, and he's kind of like new money in a way. But then you've got like the mob coming in later, but it's still Horace DeWent behind the scenes. This idea of like the money is trying to buy acceptability. Everybody's trying to turn it into something that's respectable, but it just can't. You can't hide that dirty money. You know, F. Scott Fitzgerald, isn't it?
Yeah. I was about to say, yeah. I mean, it really is that, isn't it? And the sense of the 1945 ball. And all of that.
And I like the fact that they're celebrating this 1945 end of the war ball with hundreds of Japanese lanterns. About the same time, we're dropping the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Yeah. It's that lovely kind of poor taste kind of decor choice. I didn't really get that, but yeah.
I agree with what you're saying about the kind of sense of society and class.
Yeah. And also because King has gone from being very poor to now being quite rich. He's very successful at this point. Carrie's sold for a lot of money, and Salem's Lot, and the book Shining got a massive advance on those, and also we've got money from the films of Carrie and the films of Salem's Lot, which have come out at this point. So yeah, he's also had this kind of very American rise from dirt poor to struggling teacher to struggling writer to the most, you know, famous writer in America at this point, I would say. So it's interesting, that trajectory. And I think part of Jack's fear is the idea that can be taken away. Mm. The idea that, you know, you could just be like three bad decisions away from picking fruit in California. Mm. Or in Jack and King's case, a couple of drunken mistakes. Because you got to remember that this is being written at the time that Stephen King is a functioning alcoholic. He's drinking a lot of beer, taking a lot of pills, doing a lot of crazy stuff. And yeah, it's interesting that he writes about a guy in recovery as well, when he himself is not in recovery. Because it's very convincing writing about a guy who's quit drinking when he hasn't done that himself.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, a writer should be able to write everything, but I think looking back, this one's really close to home, isn't it?
Yeah. There's always that sense, often when the stuff I've read about him talking about it, something quite confessional about it in that way, isn't it?
Yeah, he's very open about his addictions, which didn't really stop, I think, until there's an intervention in about 83, and then he gets clean, and I think Needful Things is the first book that he writes absolutely stone-cold sober. Mm. But yeah, I think The Shining, I don't know, do you see it as like maybe a cry for help? Maybe it's saying, you know?
Yeah.
Because he's very open about the fact that he also harbored violent thoughts towards his children. Absolutely. And his wife while he was writing it. And in the miniseries we talked about earlier, there's a lot of AA talk. They've got a big book and they're going to meetings, and I think King's gone through that process as well at that point. Yeah, he would know that. So it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It is.
To write a book,
considering there's such a, you know, it's a hopeful ending.
Yeah.
But without Jack in it.
Because they kill off the abusive father and replace him with Dick Halloran, who's this like nice guy who saves the day at the end of it and is black against the whiteness of the Overlook, which is shrouded in whiteness, white everywhere. And then you have this kind of this black guy coming and dispersing it and saying, no, set it on fire, we got to go, you know?
Yeah. He's a magnificent character. I mean, that chapter when he talks to Danny, beautifully written, and it's really quite touching, isn't it? Because you got the sense of the the camaraderie between the connection.
Yeah.
As well as being, yeah, this exploration of something, you know, shout at me in your mind, which is nearly fatal. But it's a very warming scene. You know, it's a great one. I think that's a great characterization there by
King. Really, it's also the only time you see Danny being unguarded around an adult. Because with his parents, he's always like trying to keep the peace, or he's trying to hide something. This is the only time he's kind of really, he feels he can be honest with somebody. And I think that's beautiful. Because for me, the hardest scenes in the books are where Danny is being like a toy between his two parents, are being pushed back and forth. And I think those are like the really gruesome sequences. That's a bit that's hard to watch, man. It's terrible.
And it's an interesting relationship with Tony.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously it is himself.
Sure,
you know,
yeah.
No major surprise, perhaps. But that's interesting, that link there, and you're on your own, Danny, really, isn't it?
Exactly.
Is what it means.
Yeah.
You know?
And like at the end, he talks about Tony as being like an older version of himself, but also a younger version of his father, how he's halfway between that adult and child stage. And I think he realises that Tony is the point in which he can make that decision to like do well or do horribly, you know, go off to his father or try and do something better. Well, we know what he does because of Dr. Sleep, as I've said. But so I'm a bit of a completist when it comes to these things. So I've read Before the Play and After the Play, which were two short stories written by King. Before the Play was published in a magazine in 82, and that's a prologue to The Shining, which deals with a few of the historical precedents. And After the Play is kind of an epilogue in which it's Danny graduates, having become Tony, and sees his father's ghost. And I can kind of see why they were cut, but there are some interesting bits in there as well. You learn a lot more about Bob Watson, the man who built the place, and Horace De Winter, who took it over. And you kind of realize the effect this place has on these people. So what do you think it is about the Overlook Hotel? Is it like, is it hell? Is it the afterlife? Is it cursed? Because in the film, in Kubrick's film, they say, oh, it's built on an Indian burial site. Mm. And that's kind of all the explanation you need, I think, these days, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's basically it. Like, oh, that explains everything.
Real estate.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But for you, what is the Overlook?
Yeah, I could see why people think it's hell and, you know, the devil's in there and everything. I think for me, it's something very Poe. I think it is the sense of that cursed in environment.
Yeah.
And thinking in particular, like with the way Poe's been adapted by people like Stephen Berkoff, with his adaptation of Fall of the House of Usher, where, you know, he really pushes that sense, the walls are my skin, this room is my heart. And, you know, that sense, and the sense of the character of the hotel is really enormous. So for me, it's that sense of something very benighted, and, you know,
I think that's
what it is there, yeah. There's the fascination, I think, that sense of architecture, the cursed architecture, and the, you know, the haunted buildings and the spaces that aren't quite right. And, you know,
as we mentioned earlier, to me, this is one of the archetypal, one of the best haunted house novels. There's this and Haunting of Hill House, of course, and House of Seven Gables as well, I think, is also kind of excellent in there. But yeah, this really is like the modern haunted house novel, isn't it? I can't think of anything else to compare, certainly.
Absolutely, yeah. And that sense of what that means to be haunted, and that sort of baggage of the past, isn't it? And that is fascinating, isn't it? And that is hauntology, isn't it? The sense of the present can only exist with the ghosts of the past.
Yeah.
Everything is determined by people whose perhaps their impact may be stronger than ours, kind of thing. There's balance there.
That's interesting.
And that overwhelming sense. And I think The Overlook is very much that, isn't it?
Yeah, they do talk about
this oppression
idea
of the past.
Yeah, the past is crashing into the present.
Yeah.
You know, in quite a literal way, with the kind of the elevator going up and down and bringing the past down into the present to scare the present. And also the idea of, like, it's like a palimpsest, isn't it? It's kind of written on top of each other. So you have, they talk about the fact they don't know which year it is. They talk about the fact that time is kind of stopped but also overlapping on itself. And I think that's really interesting, the idea that, yeah, like we said earlier, you can't figuratively escape your past, but you can't literally escape the past either. Mm-hmm. It's going to get you. It's going to come back and it's going to get you. You know?
Yeah. And that sense, again, that's another Poe thing, isn't it? What's buried beneath the floorboards or behind the brick wall or whatever, you know? And,
That which is not dead can eternal lie, man. You know? Did you have any problems with The Shining? Was there anything you might have changed or anything you think didn't particularly work?
No, I think I'm very positive about it, really. Mm-hmm. I think it's great. I mean, I think it's one of those things, again, the Kubrick film, which was my first encounter with the story.
I think that's most people's way into the book these days.
And actually, I found it's a book of delights in a way because of,
definitely,
I don't know, poor phrase probably for this, but there's so much in there that depth of the characterization, and you can see actually what Kubrick's done is a very fantastically nuanced streamlining, concision, all these things, these adaptive techniques are just brilliantly done. But actually, it's a real treat, I think, to have more of that sense of the backstory and more of the sense of the, you know, the being inside the head of Jack.
That's the thing he nails, is like this three-way kind of way of writing where you hear from Jack, you hear from Wendy, and you hear from Danny, and they all have a very distinctive voice, and you all feel for them in some way. You attach yourself to them on some level. And I think it does have to be about, you have to love the characters in horror, because if you don't love the characters, it doesn't really matter. It's just meat. It's just meat.
Yeah.
You have to feel yourself liking them or loving them at some point, some kind of empathy there. And I think that's what this book really nails, mainly through, as I was saying earlier, fear. It plays on fears that we all have. The fear we're not going to be a good father, or the fear that, you know, We can't stop drinking, or the fear that, you know, like we're going to lose our jobs and have to go begging to our parents. That's a big theme in the book, isn't it? This idea of you have to return to your parents and beg them. You know, it's sort of a modern horrors.
I suppose one thing that I certainly found rereading it as well, the kind of the hedge animals and things like that. I mean, it's quite interesting, but it's not as terrifying as things behind a pink.
I kind of ruined that for myself by watching the miniseries recently, and that kind of this very early CGI for the hedge animals, and it just looks rubbish.
And I think it may have been that for me rereading it, thinking actually that is stock in trade of so much CGI now, isn't
it? Exactly.
When Harry Potter or anything, you'll have things brought to life. So that's one thing I sort of wrangled with a bit. Relieved it's not in the Kubrick film.
Definitely.
But also in that kind of spectrum of horror, there's other things in it.
It does seem a little out of place in a classic haunted house novel, though it did remind me a lot of The Marble Faun, you know, that one?
Yeah.
That idea of they're coming to life in the garden kind of thing. But yeah, I know what you mean.
Or it's a kind of La Belle et la Bête, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Cocteau kind of stuff. Yeah, that it's magical, it's magic realism kind of thing, more than some of the mundane horrors.
Definitely.
Simplistic scenarios. Yeah. Squittering sound as something's behind you. You know?
I did kind of think at the point where Halloran kind of comes to rescue them and he gets attacked by the lions, I was like, just get to the hotel. I don't care about this. Just get to there. This seems like a meaningless kind of thing. You know?
So I think for me it felt a bit baroque or something, you know.
And you're right, the Kubrick, I think, made the right decision by having a maze,
which is
a lot more gothic. It's a lot more, I think it speaks to more of the fact they're trapped, you know, they can't find a way out, and it gives you that lovely set piece at the end where Nicholson's chasing Danny. So on to you, Richard Hand. Tell me a bit about the Edgar Allan Poe Theatre, please.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, delighted to be part of the Edgar Allan Theatre on the Air project, which is based in Baltimore.
Lovely.
And it's the leader of it is a guy called Alex Avestovich, who's a well-known theatre director in America. He used to be based more in Washington, where he had the Molotov Theatre Group, which is still running, but actually now he's doing the National Edgar Allan Poe Theatre. He's doing more work there, and for their kind of endeavours, they wanted some audio output. So they asked me to be kind of script writer on that. It's been tremendous fun. It's now opening out to more writers as well.
Very cool.
Brilliant.
How many episodes have you done so far?
We've done about eight scripts.
Sure.
I think about 5 of those are released so far.
Okay.
So,
what stories have you covered?
We've done some of the old favourites. You'd Want to See the Black Cat,
yep.
Telltale Heart. But we've also had fun doing Berenice and sort of more neglected ones. We're currently working on the script of The Oval Portrait.
Oh, that's a deep cut.
Oh, absolutely, So it's quite fun putting these obscurities in there.
No.
So the way they're kind of 20 minutes long, and they've been taken up by National Public Radio in America, so we're delighted about that.
And NPR,
sponsorship
well
from
done.
Raven Beer. but I know they've done live performances of a couple, like in the Edgar Allan Poe House in Baltimore, because they've got a really good link with the Poe heritage there.
Very cool.
Who are very keen on anything to get people interested in Poe, and so performing Telltale Heart in Poe's bedroom.
I can imagine.
I wish I'd been there, but it sounded great.
So where can people find these?
It's on the WYPR station.
But
sure. You can find it through American NPR. Mm-hmm. You can search for it there and they'll come up.
Yeah, I found it through the Apple Podcasts app as well. It's all on there. And I think it's probably on Spotify as well at this point.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Podbean, Stitch, or any kind of podcatcher you like would probably find it. I've listened to a few of them now and they're absolutely wonderful. It's,
thank you. Yeah.
It's a very... It captures kind of the horror, kind of the gruesomeness of Poe, but also the wittiness of it, that kind of playfulness he had in his writing, which I think is really underrated. He was kind of very much a humorist as well,
well
as this guy who's kind of got this reputation for scary stories. It's also very, very funny, so I recommend that very highly.
Thank you very much, Richard. Brilliant. The other thing I should say, we sort of developed a premise where it's set in a lunatic asylum.
Mm.
So, and it is a sort of tribute to 40s radio, but also Amicus horror films and all about that portmanteau.
Sure. Yeah, asylum.
So the
one,
listener who never speaks because it's us, we're being shown around by Dr. Mallard showing his inmates in his asylum.
Very cool.
And talking about his method. And it's meant to be playful, a bit of fun as well, as you're listening, hopefully begin to work out which story it is that you're about to be locked in the cell with.
So it's going to have an arc inside, an overreaching arc for all the stories as well. That's fascinating. So what's coming up? What are you doing next?
Well, we're wrapping up The Oval Portrait, and actually another writer's tackled Monsieur Valdemar.
I love that one.
Doing that one, so it'd be fun. But they're interested in doing more, and I think as long as Raven Beer keeps sponsoring it and NPR keep hosting it, we'll be fine.
Absolutely.
sounds like you're onto something.
Yeah, absolutely. No, judging by the reviews and the feedback I've read, it seems to be doing very well. So, and I'm so glad that people are talking about Poe. I'm always up for a bit of that. You know, he seems to be the forgotten man recently.
That's right. I mean, that's one reason I think Alex Avestovich got the major commission with the National Edgar Allan Poe Theatre. Was they did a adaptation of Poe's stories in Washington, and they had real success and award-winning kind of production. But high school kids were going along, dragged along probably, but really enjoyed the show, as well as horror aficionados who love Molotov Theatre for their horror theatre. But also people interested in literature and, you know, interested in Poe adaptations or 19th century adaptations. So they had a terrific demographic for that, and I think that was the springboard for the National Edgar Allan Poe stuff.
And now it's a podcast, which is like the most cutting edge medium you can bloody get, isn't
Absolutely.
It? I mean, this is where it's all happening, isn't it? I hope so anyway. I certainly hope so. You're also adapting Henry James's The Turn of the Screw for the Sewell Barn Theatre next year. Can you tell us a bit about that as well?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, that's what we're doing is a stage production of William Archibald's adaptation of Turn of the Screw, which is called The Innocents. Wonderful title, I must say.
Yeah, great film as well.
That's right, And the stage play was from around 1950. Huge hit on Broadway and the West End.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't been performed for a long, long time. Partly it's a very 1950s play.
Sure. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's a very well-made play, but the key thing is with it, Archibald kind of takes sides. The ghosts are very much real.
Oh, okay.
So the governess at the centre of the story confronts them.
There's no ambiguity.
The ambiguity's gone. Now, what we've done with our production is we've brought the ambiguity back.
Sure.
Partly by looking very closely at the screenplay of the film version. Truman Capote, John Mortimer, even Harold Pinter had some involvement. They took it back to James, to Henry James's ambiguity, And that's what we've kind of restored in it. And it's interesting because when I was had the chance to direct it, somebody did say to me, oh, why William Archibald's adaptation? There's loads of others and there's some fantastic versions. But actually, there's something fascinating about William Archibald's adaptation, I think. It does have a wonderful quality. The speeches for Mrs. Gross, Miss Giddens, who they call the governess, and the two children are wonderful. And it's some wonderful writing, and there's no doubt about it. And, of course, Archibald was involved in the screenplay. But it's just sort of rethinking, taking back that ambiguity. And, of course, that's something we can do in a stage production as well.
Yeah, I can
where
imagine.
We do have two spectres of Quint.
I was going to say, I do want to, I know it's ambiguous, but I do want to see some ghosts.
Yeah, it's like with Macbeth, isn't it? Banquo's ghost. The best ones are when you see it.
Yeah, you can't have somebody just looking shocked into a corner. You know, it's ridiculous.
But when we're performing at the Sewell Barn in Norwich, which is a wonderful old theatre space, lots of staircases, lots of balconies. So we've had great fun already getting ready with this in terms of where people can suddenly appear and disappear from. So that's quite fun. So that's certainly... and also we've kind of... the second half of the play, we've really kind of reined in and streamlined, and hopefully the stage design will work for people because the play transforms in that second half. As we enter the maelstrom towards the end.
You know. So I kind of have to ask, I know you're in the middle of rehearsals and planning at the moment. Did The Shining give you any ideas?
Well, I think that sense of architecture, that sense of building, sense of pace, I think a lot of those things are there. We've introduced some scenes to it. How Archibald's play work is you get the sense of a day in the late autumn and then it's the next morning. And that happens several times. But what we're doing with those in-between scenes is creating some sense of the house at night.
Sure.
And because there's a description of the new governess exploring the house, all 135 rooms or whatever it is. So she will be exploring the house in between scenes, working with a guy called Phil Rowe, who's doing the sound design for it. And that's been fantastic. Initially, he was going to do some compositions, but we will have no music, but we will have whispers.
Interesting.
Breathing, heartbeats, embodied sounds, which I think is the sound of that house.
Yeah, man. So I always think the hardest part about Turn of the Screw is the kids. So you've got some good child actors, I hope?
That's right, yeah. When I first sort of put out the call, for auditions, I was prepared to take sort of young adults and, you know, and I've seen that done in other adaptations and that can work well.
Because there are some dark themes here for a kid.
There are. And that's
going on.
That's quite an interesting thing. But in the end, we had a lot of children audition and a couple, luckily the two we've got as Miles and Flora, were brilliant in the audition. And so they got the parts. They're 12 and 13, so they play the 8 and 12-year-old quite
sure,
well.
Yeah.
And it's been really fascinating working with them. And you're right, they're dark themes. It's a very creepy story. What we're working on our ghosts to be as creepy as possible.
Good. Yeah.
But we're a very happy ensemble. So it's all been a happy process. So it's, hopefully for the audience, they may think, how on earth could this work? But for us as a team, it's good fun.
I can imagine. And you can find out for yourself when the play opens on the 9th of January 2020. It runs until the 11th and then picks up again on the 15th all the way through to the 18th. Tickets available at www.sewellbarn. That's SEWELLBARN.org. And you can get tickets from there. It's £10 entry or £9 for concessions. And, I'm really looking forward to it myself. I can't get enough of these haunted houses, you know?
That's one other thing. I understand there's a stage adaptation of The Shining being put together with Simon Stevens, the author, I think.
So. Yeah, which is interesting. I was kind of reading it. I did kind of think this would work quite well on a stage because you've got a very limited number of sets.
Yeah.
And you've got that kind of the idea of passing time. Kind of, it stays in one place. So, it could be great, or it could be another Carrie musical.
Absolutely, because I recently saw David Gregg's adaptation of Solaris.
How was that?
Which was brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant because they had numerous quite short scenes with very clever scene changes.
Okay.
Quite minimal, but it absolutely persuaded you that you were exploring different aspects of the spaceship.
Oh, that's cool.
So it occurred to me when I read about the potential Shining adaptation, I thought, well, if they approach it like that, you get a sense of the scale of the building these people are in.
Yeah.
That could be key to it.
Yeah, and if they can avoid, like I say, the Kubrick factor, which is, you know, so it's so iconic and embedded in people's minds. And later on this month, I'll be talking to Dr. Vincent Gain about the Kubrick adaptation. I'll also be talking to my regular collaborator, Craig Appleby, about the lesser collaborations, which is to say the TV miniseries and Room 237. So keep tuned for those, and feel free to write to us at theconstantreaderpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you very much, Richard Hand, for joining us today.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening to The Constant Reader Podcast, hosted by me, Richard Shepherd. Don't forget to rate, review, like, and subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, Stitcher, and any other podcatcher you may use. And with thanks to Stephen Parks for his production skills, and thanks to UEA for their continued use of the media recording studio. Thank you very much.